Start the recording. Okay, we're going to put everybody on a temporary mute. Feel free to unmute as you go. That is interesting. It did not. Okay, feel free to unmute as you go. If you're on a computer, you can simply unmute by holding the space bar. If you're on an iPad or iPhone, then you have to press the unmute button. And we are ready to start. Okay, I think. Let's do this. And this. There we go. Now I see your videos. Okay. Yes, everybody good? Thumbs up. Perfect. Okay, we were going through the story of Perek Yadalad, which is Yoav. At the beginning of the Perek, it starts with Vayida Yoav ben Tzruya ki lev hamelech alav shalom. Yoav begins to sense that David's heart was leaning towards Avshalom, even though Avshalom was in exile for 3 years for having murdered his brother. And or exile permanently. It turns out that it was only for 3 years. And so Yoav decides to begin a plan to enable David to save face and bring Avshalom back, or at least want to bring him back. And so he engages the services of this Isha Chachama Mitokoa. Why she's referred to as a Isha Chachama, a wise woman, where her wisdom fits in, we will, Bezrat Hashem, see. Though it is a couple of shiurim from now. We have a few things we have to get through before we get to the analysis of her chokhmah, but it's certainly one of the issues in this parak. And she begins to, he tells her a story, and he says, this is what you have to say. She engages with David, and she says to him, and she tells him this story. And the story has to do with the fact that she's a widow and that she has two sons, one killed the other, which of course sets up the analogy to Avshalom and Amnon, much like Natan had said to David a whole story that kind of reminded him of the story of Bathsheba, and then said, Atah Ha'ish. In this story, the Goale Hadam, the Avengers are a blood, meaning the people who are there, members of the family who are there to defend the blood of the victim, in this case, the brother who was killed, who want to kill the remaining brother for the purpose of ostensibly vengeance and justice, but really she suspects it's because they would become the heirs to the inheritance. And that gives them a mixed motive. Eventually she cries out to David for help, and David agrees, and he says, Chai Hashem imipo misarat b'nech arza. He takes an oath that nothing will come will happen to her son. And at that point, she shifts gears, and she says, I would like to speak my heart to the king. And the king, and the king says, Daberi, and she begins to speak. And when she begins to speak, suddenly her story becomes a little bit less coherent, a little bit less articulate. And we're going to have to kind of figure out, again, once we get through the parak, we'll have to come back to this and figure out exactly what she is trying to say to David. Why would you think such a thing about the people of God? When speaking this word, the king is as one that is guilty, in not returning his banished one. We will certainly die like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. God does not favor any soul. And let him devise a means that he that is banished shall not be banished. He that is an outcast shall not be an outcast. Whatever that phrase is. Means. the reason I have come to speak this to the king is because the people, ki yir'uni ha'am, they've made me afraid. She made servant, I will now speak to the king, that it may be the will of the king to perform the request of a servant. The king will certainly hear my plea to save me and my family, my son, from the inheritor, from the Goele Adam, from those who would destroy me and my son. And again, she seems to be staying in the role of this story that she, either true or not true and unclear. And she pleads one more time that the king should hear, because the king is like an angel of God, a representative of God, and can hear good and evil and judge accordingly. To which she then says, V'yana melech v'yomer l'isha, tell me something. The king says to her, tell me something truthful and do not hide from me. Hayad Yoav haya b'davar hazeh. Hayad Yoav itach b'chol zot. Was Yoav involved in this? Did Yoav put you up to this? And so the question I think we ended with last week was, what is it that she said that was A, so incoherent altogether, but B, was able to David's sensitive ear, David immediately picked up that Yad Yoav, that the hand of Yoav was involved. Clearly, Yoav put her up to it. Yoav gave her the story. Yoav told her to come. And although she doesn't understand why, David doesn't, right? This is David has to uncover this mystery. And that's what he does. Yad Yoav itach b'chol zot. She said, of course. And she doesn't hide from him. And that the purpose of all of this is Yoav has done this thing in order to change your heart in this matter. And my master, you know all that is in the land. So after it's all said and done, and this is more or less what we got up to last week, after all said and done, right, so let's just stop here for a second. I'm going to stop the share. Let's just put this together for a second. Yoav sees that David wants to bring Avshalom back. Avshalom is guilty of murder. Avshalom is guilty of killing his brother, killing the heir to the throne. Avshalom is guilty of treason. Avshalom is in exile for all of the above. David is pining for Avshalom. Yoav orchestrates this story of this Ishat Gui to come and plead to David a story that would remind him of the importance of this sense of compassion, one brother for another. And ultimately, the same way he would protect the brother remaining of this woman, David would see enough of the story to recognize and protect or bring back, enable him to bring back Avshalom. The moment David uncovers the ruse, uncovers that Yad Yoav, that this is all from Yoav, says to her, did Yoav put you up to this? She says, you are smarter than anybody around. Yes, Yoav put me up to this. David then turns to Yoav. And we expect David to say to Yoav, what would we expect David to say to Yoav? Expect David to say to Yoav, how dare you? What are you meddling for? His brother's committed treason. He's committed, the analysis, the parallel between this story and that she presents and the story of David and Avshalom is clearly not a clear analogy. Avshalom is crown prince, killed the crown prince. Avshalom killed his brother in cold blood. This was a case of two people fighting. This was a case of the only surviving brother. This is a case of the inheritance. All the reasons why the stories aren't the same. And yet, instead of all of that, what does David do instead? David turns to Yoav and says, "Vayomer HaMelech Yoav, Hinei na asiti et davar hazeh. Lech hashev tanar et Avshalom." Okay, I acquiesce. Go and bring back Avshalom. ויפו יואב על פניו ארצה, וישתחו ויברך את המלך, ויאמר יואב, היום ידע עבדך, כי מצאתיך מעיניך, אדוני. Today, I have found favor in your eyes, אשר עשה המלך את דבר עבדך. King has performed the request of his servant. I mean, talk about things being upside down. Here, I have made a request, and instead of dismissing it for a change, the king has agreed. Yaakov Yoav Bayelech Geshur. So the king goes, so Yoav goes to Geshur. Geshur is the area where the where Avshalom is in exile. Avshalom has run to his grandfather. Remember, his mother is Ma'cha Bat Melech Geshur, Tamai Melech Geshur. He ran to the king of Geshur. Where Geshur is a discussion. Most commentaries assume that Geshur is what is referred to in most places in Tanakh as an area of the Golan or Aram, Syria, Iraq sort of arena, for reasons that are I might add as kind of a postscript to this chapter at the end. It's also possible that Geshur is in the area of Edom in the south near Egypt. Unclear. I'll leave that for now. It's just informational. It's not really significant. But Ve'eve et Avshalom Yerushalayim. He goes to Geshur and he invites Avshalom back to Yerushalayim. Avshalom comes back to Yerushalayim. David has finally acquiesced to accept Avshalom. David has agreed to Yoav's plan to bring Avshalom back to the to have compassion. The woman's story was about compassion. Clearly, David will have compassion for Avshalom. The woman's story was about preserving the son's dignity. Clearly, David will have compassion for Avshalom's dignity. That is the anticipation. Yoav goes to Geshur and invites Avshalom back to Yerushalayim. And so he comes. Vayomer HaMelech, the moment Avshalom steps foot in Yerushalayim, says David, Yisov el beto ufanai lo yireh. He will go to his house, my face he shall not see. Yisov Avshalom el beto ufnei HaMelech lo ra'ah. Gets sent home and does not see the king's face, meaning he does not come to the palace. He goes to his house. He's probably placed under some kind of house arrest. He does not see the king. He does not get embraced by the king. He does not get greeted by the king. The palace is a region he may not enter. This is Avshalom returning, not in pride and dignity and majesty and royal highness, crown prince now Avshalom, but this is Avshalom returning into house arrest in shame. David won't even see him. And that also is part of the challenge here. I think at the end of this year, we asked the question, so why bring him home in the first place? And if you're not going to see him, if you're not going to greet him, then why bring him into the... why put him through all of the turmoil of bringing him to Yerushalayim? That's the story. Okay. And I think it kind of leaves us hanging here. What's to become of Avshalom? And then the text goes on to this little vignette. Just to kind of put in perspective, Pasuk of Dalid, V'yomer HaMelech Yisov al Beito Ufanai Lo Yireh, V'yisov Avshalom al Beito Ufanei HaMelech Lo Ra'ah. I'm going to jump, skip 1, 2, 3 psukim, and read pasuk of chet. Vayeshev Avshalom b'Yerushalayim shnatayim yamim. Avshalom sat and dwelt in Yerushalayim for 2 years. Ufne hamelach lo ra'ah, did not see the king's face. 2 years. So he spends three years in exile in Melach Eretz Geshur. He comes back to Yerushalayim. David says, I won't see him. And for 2 years, he's under house arrest. He cannot see the king. In between, I have 3 psukim. that are so clearly Pasuk Chaf Dalet and Chaf Chet are interconnected, right? He goes to his house, and there he stays for 2 years. What's in between? What's in between is a description of Avshalom. Did we read these Pesukim last week? I don't think so. What's in between is a description of Avshalom. Avshalom lo haya ish yafeh b'cho Yisrael lahalel ma'od. There was none in Israel as beautiful as Avshalom. Mikaf raglo v'yad kod kodo. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. In English today, you'd say from head to toe. In biblical Hebrew, it's reversed, from toe to head. Mikaf raglo v'ad kod kodo. Lo haya b'mum. He was perfect, no blemish. Handsome, beautiful, ish yafeh. Not only does he ish yafeh, he had this beautiful, long, curly hair. That was extraordinary. When he would cut his hair, and every year he would cut his hair because it was heavy, it was long, and they would cut it. They would weigh the amount of hair. He would cut his hair off, they would weigh it. And it came to the weight of 200 shekels of silver. I have no idea what that means, but in the weights of the king. I have no idea. Is that an exaggeration or not an exaggeration? But it's clearly, he had a lot of hair. He had beautiful locks of hair. Cut it every year. Big ceremony. They would weigh it. The weighing of Avshalom's hair, quite significant. Avshalom is handsome, tall, beautiful, long, flowing curls in his hair, locks.
Does that remind of Joseph?
Oh, so we're going to talk about Joseph. That's a fascinating parallel because it's a medrash about Joseph. But I think the medrash is taken from here. I think I mentioned in the past the notion that there are certain midrashim that are built around biblical arenas, biblical stories that are borrowed and then superimposed elsewhere in midrashim. This is one of those examples, I think, correct about Yosef. But we'll come to that in a second. But Avshalom lo haya ish yafeh. Avshalom was beautiful. He was tall. He was handsome. He had beautiful hair. He had a family. Vayevaldu l'Avshalom shlosha banim. He had three sons. He had a daughter, bat achat. What do you think he named his daughter? Tamar. No surprise. Ushma Tamar. She was also beautiful. And there Avshalom sat in Yerushalayim for 2 years, did not see the king. And the real question, of course, is what's the issue in this text? Simple question that needs a heavy answer.
Why are there three pasukim that don't relate to Avshalom not seeing the king?
The subject here in the section that I've just highlighted, right? Sorry, the highlights don't work on this website. I'm not sure why. The subject here, where did I just go? The subject here is Ufne Melech Lava'ah. The subject here is David's decree that Avshalom shall not see the king. Starts in Pasuk Chaf Dalet, continues in Pasuk Chaf Chet. In between, I have three psukim that talk about how beautiful Avshalom is. Who cares? Who cares? Why is Avshalom's beauty even a factor in the text? I have no idea why it's even a factor in the text. And number two, why is it here? Now, you could argue, and I think it's a reasonable argument, that we need to know about his hair. Why do I need to know about his hair? Of all the pieces of information here, the only one that's of any practical value is the fact that he has long hair. Why is his hair of any practical value?
Yeah. Foreshadowing.
Because
he gets caught by...
Correct, because his hair is how he ultimately dies. right, in the battle of Machanaim, in the battle of Yair Ephraim, when he's in the civil war that will ensue in the rebellion, a couple of chapters from now, he's riding on a horse. He was riding on a donkey, and his long hair gets caught in the tree, and it pulls him off. The animal goes running, and he's literally hanging from his hair. And that's the story, and ultimately, that's how Yoav catches him, and kills him. So his hair is eventually going to be his downfall, which is pretty ironic. And it sets up that irony that here his hair is a source of his great beauty. And eventually that same beautiful locks of long hair will be his downfall. That's fine. But why do I need to know that now? Avshalom is not rebelling. This is not the rebellion. This Avshalom is as far from that war with David as besides the fact that it's three chapters from now. What relevance is it? So here's what I want to do today. I want to take a look at this story and kind of analyze what's going on here. And time permitting, we'll read the rest of the parak after that. But to start, we really need to look at how the Mefarshim deal with this. So the simplest, I would say the classic approach, which is in the Rishonim and the Kruok Dalot. Take a look, for example, at the Radak. And I like this website because I can just pull the Radak and other Mefarshim off the right on the page. Avshalom lo haya ish yafeh b'chol Yisrael, right? This beauty of Avshalom, says the Radak the following. Avshalom lo haya ish yafeh samuch l'sipur hamered. This story is very close to the story of the rebellion. We're in chapter 14. The rebellion will start at the beginning of chapter 15. Your opening sentence of chapter 15 is Avshalom gathers horses, chariots, 50 men to run before him and start his rebellion against the king. So we're close. We're not there yet. He's still under house arrest. He still hasn't rebelled. But we're close. Samuch l'sipur hamered. Shemerad b'aviv, because he rebels against his father. And therefore, siper magaram lo zeh. We're being told what caused Avshalom to rebel. So you might think it's the fact that he killed his brother and he had to go into exile. You might think it's the fact that his father did nothing to defend the integrity of his sister Tamar. You might think it's the fact that his father has refused to punish Amnon and Avshalom had to take the matter into his own hand. Or the fact that he feels that David is not demonstrating justice and defending the integrity of the people and failing as a king. All of those things maybe you might thought might be justifications for Avshalom's rebellion. Says the Radak, no, not so. What caused Avshalom to rebel? Haya yafeh. He was beautiful. He was handsome. U'b'chol Yisrael lo haya kamo. He was more handsome than anybody else in all of Israel. And therefore, nitga'e b'yofyo. He was arrogant in his beauty. U'b'saro, and in his hair. V'te'ateshev ki ein ra'ui l'melucha b'nei David kamo. And he said, there is none as worthy amongst the children of David to reign as was he. And therefore, umarat, he rebelled. Ulai shema ki b'lev ha-melech lamlich Shlomo acharav. Maybe he heard that David wants to put Shlomo on his throne after him. Umarad alavi b'chayav, and therefore he started this rebellion while his father was still alive. But Ganav lev Yisrael, and he stole the hearts of Israel. The people went with Avshalom. So parenthetically, open up a kind of a parenthetical aside, this issue about Shlomo is Radak and most of the Mefarshim sort of consistent with their position that Shlomo is already born at the end of the story of Bathsheba. We had suggested for various textual and historical reasons that the birth of Shlomo is later. So that particular piece of it is not, I would say, is not relevant. But what Radak is essentially saying is, why is his beauty a factor in the story? His beauty is a factor in the story because Avshalom essentially was was kind of seeing his beauty as a kind of defense, was a kind of a source of his arrogance to say, I am the worthy one to reign. Here I am, the most handsome, beautiful, tall, long hair. I look the majestic part. I feel that majestic. I am Avshalom. Here's my long hair. Nobody is beautiful. Beauty and arrogance, essentially, says the Vedak, is what go together. And that beauty and arrogance in this particular case is a very dangerous combination. And in Avshalom's case, it leads him to delusions of grandeur, of malchus, of reigning, of ruling, and of ultimately rebelling against David. That, says the Radak, is the story. And in that context, Joyce is correct. It's very reminiscent of another similar story about long hair, which is the Midrash. Rashi quotes it, and I'm going to show it to you here in the source page. Rashi quotes it in the context of Yosef in the beginning of Parshat Vayeshev. V'hu na'ar et b'nei bilhav et b'nei zilpa. Yosef was the young Yosef, na'ar, together with the children of the Shvachot, b'nei bilhav et b'nei zilpa. And ultimately, the next pasuk is that the brothers hated him and they were jealous of him, etc. What is v'hu na'ar? Says Rashi, based on the Medrash, she'a osem ma'asen na'arut. He performed acts that were, na'ar means young. Young boy, but now in colloquial terms can also mean foolish, right? He's a nah, he's a fool. Meaning he would act like a young, arrogant kid would act when he feels that he's better than everybody else. How? Mitaken b'sa'aro, he would fix his hair, mimashmesh b'enav, and he would fix his eyes. So that he should look handsome. And again, to Rashi, it's about the foolishness of Yosef, who already at this point sees himself. Yaakov has given him a ketanat pasim. Yaakov has given him the position of leadership. He's the youngest of the brothers, and yet Yaakov has said, you will be the leader. Right? Much as Avshalom is the younger of the brothers, and here he says he'll be the leader. Yosef is yafeh, he's very beautiful, he's handsome. Avshalom is very handsome. So Chazal already hear the connection and link in the Medrash, link the hair of Avshalom to the curls of the hair of Yosef. And that's a Medrash, not in the text, but I think it's very compelling based on the circumstances that compare Yosef to Avshalom. And that's essentially what the Medrash, the Radak is saying, that the purpose of telling us of Avshalom's beauty is to describe Avshalom's arrogance so we understand what ultimately motivates him to rebel. Okay, that's the Radak. There's one problem with this Radak, though, and why I'm looking for an alternative, which is
why does it say it right here?
Right, exactly right. What relevance is Avshalom's rebellion to Perek Yud Dalet? If this was the introduction to Perek Tedvav, Avshalom's rebellion starts with a sense of arrogance and greater importance than he really has, etc., I totally buy it. But it's in the middle of the description in Perek Yudal that David has just brought Avshalom home. He was in exile for 3 years. How beautiful can he look after exile for 3 years? It's an exile for 3 years sitting in Geshur. David finally agrees to bring him home. He sends him out to his house into house arrest. And we're told that he's so beautiful, he's ready to rebel. I mean, maybe at the end of the parak, but we're not a long way from the parak. So in a sense, what the Radak is saying is that arrogance is already starting. We'll see a little bit of it at the end of the continuation of the parak. And that arrogance is part of the story. So Adak essentially's argument is that it's his arrogance that will fuel the remaining of this perek. But it's interesting that it literally is squarely in the middle of this statement. Vayisov Avshalom el beito ufne hamelech lo ra'ah, the king refused to see him. Ufne hamelech lo ra'ah, the king refused to see him. Avshalom was very handsome and beautiful. It almost reads like, despite Avshalom's beauty, the king refused to see him. I mean, that's how the flow reads. Despite the fact that Avshalom was so beautiful and handsome, the king didn't look at him. as if to say, if you looked at him, he would be overwhelmed by his beauty, which is quite ironic. But that, in fact, is another approach that I've seen written about this story. I'll share it with you. There's a essentially the contemporary understanding of Tanakh breaks down into, or scholars in Tanakh break down into two schools, right? There's the classic Mefarshim that you'll find in the Kruk Dalot, the Rishonim and Achronim, and then there's contemporary commentaries that have published many, many volumes of commentary and insight on Tanakh. Today, in the world of the Beit Midrash of Tanakh, you have names like Rav Yoel Ben-Nun, Rav Amnon Bazak, Rav Yaakov Maidan, and many others. So I try to keep a little bit of a picture of what's going on in that arena. And so this is the interpretation of one of those contemporary writers, Rabbi in the Gush. He's one of the Rebbeim there, and writes quite a lot and speaks quite a lot on Tanakh. He's a student of Yoel Ben-Nun. And he has a book on Sefer Shmuel. And there in this book, he writes the following. He writes, this is just a quote, I pulled it out. Ma pesha yachasom yuchad shel David l'Avshalom. What is the unique relationship that David has to Avshalom? David has a really special relationship with Avshalom. He pines for him, even though he's committed murder and fratricide, and he yearns. He doesn't want them to kill him, even though he's leading a rebellion. It's an oddity. Why is David so taken by Avshalom? Says Rav Bazak, this is the reason this little paragraph about Avshalom's beauty is designed to answer this question. It's the beauty, it's the rare beauty of Avshalom that caught David's attention. Because David was particularly sensitive to things of beauty. Shirigishutoli ofyo, which was the source of that chait with Bathsheba, who was described as Yishayi Fatma. So David's sensitivity to beauty led him astray in the case of Bathsheba. And it is also the reason why the text assigns to David this desire, this connection to Avshalom. And in a few chapters after David's, when David is near death, and the next beginning of Sefer Melachim Aleph, and the next book opens up, we're going to find the next rebellion in David's life. And the next rebellion is led by Adoniyahu. Everybody remember who Adoniyahu is? He's the other son, right? You have Avshalom, you have Amnon, Avshalom, and then Adoniyahu. So Adoniyahu, after the death of Avshalom, and after the king is actually at the beginning of Sefer Melachim, I'll show you the psukim, beginning of the book of Kings, Amelech David Zaken Bar Bayamim, that David is very, he's very sick, he's old, Vayechasu Bav Gadim, and there's a rebellion that is launching. Adoniyahu ben Chagit mitnaseh lemor, ani amloch, and Adoniyahu ben Chagit exalted himself, saying, I'm going to be the king. Even though the king, the position of kingship has certainly at this point already been promised to Bathsheba and to son to Shlomo. We read this as Haftorah Pashat Vayechi. And so Adoniyahu ben Chagit says, no, I'm going to be the king. He gathers together horse and chariot and 50 men to run before him, which is the same exact language of the rebellion of Shalom. And his father had not challenged him in this way. He was also very handsome, very beautiful. And he was born after Avshalom. Would we have done it again? Adoniyahu decides he's going to be king because he's very handsome, because he's very beautiful? It's like a recurring theme. So says Rav Bazak, that's exactly correct. That's why Liyamim Yanik David Miototam Yachas Tamele Ben Acheshalo. That's why David will eventually have a soft spot for Adoniyahu, because Adoniyahu is also very beautiful. Unfortunately, for David, that is a soft spot that is tragic and leads to many tragedies in his life, including Bathsheba, including Adoniyahu, including of Shalom. So claims Rav Bazak. And on the face of it, the evidence is compelling. You have Avshalom, you have Adoniyahu, you have Batsheva. You have three places where David seems to have a soft spot for individuals of great beauty. But again, I think that this is a somewhat of a, I wouldn't call it superficial reading, but I think it stops short. First of all, it doesn't answer the question of why now, why here? Why in the context of saying that David refuses to see him? Unless it's saying that despite his beauty, he refuses to see him, despite that David was drawn to him, not sure why, refused to see him. But on the other hand, I would argue that what Rabbi Zak is saying is actually the exact opposite. It is true that in the world of Tanakh, it is the perception of the people that external stature is a component of the qualifications for magic, for reign and for kingship. That is true. But everything about David was the exact opposite. So let's do a quick review. Just a quick survey. Easier to see it in the text because I have a translation there. So let me show you. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet. First time we meet Shaul HaMelech. Vahi Ish mi Binyamin, Ushmo Kish ben Aviel ben Suar ben Abuchavad ben Afich ben Ishi mini Gibochayel. His father Kish was a man of great valor, was a warrior. He had a son, Shaul. His name was Shaul. And how are we told of the description of Shaul? David is not in this picture, right? David is nowhere to be seen. How are we, the people, told of the choice of Shaul? Bachur Vatov. Now, some translate the word Bachur as young. It says here, Bachur Vatov. But Bachur also means choice. Nivchar. The choicest, the best, the most handsome. Ein ish mi bnei Yisrael tov mimenu. There was nobody who looked the part better than he. Mishichmo v'mala gavah mikol ha'am, head and shoulders, towering above the rest, which is exactly where the expression comes from. Mishichmo v'mala, from the shoulders up, higher than all the rest, higher, taller than everybody else. Now, in Shaul's case, you needed somebody tall. Why did you need a king who was tall? Because his primary mission was to... Why did the Israel need a king who was tall at that moment?
Yeah, they were fighting in the field.
Who were they fighting? Who's the chief enemy in Sefer Shmuel? Take a guess, you'll probably guess right. The Plishtim. And who's the chief warrior of the Plishtim?
It's not Goliath anymore.
Goliath, right? Goliath. And what is Goliath's chief characteristic?
He's big.
So at this point in time, you needed a tall warrior, because you needed to take out Goliath. Turns out Shaul was too afraid to take out Goliath, because that battle only takes place after Shaul has already crumbled in fear. And so little David, short, little David, we'll talk about him in a second, right? He takes out Goliath, despite the fact that when Shaul sees him coming, he kind of laughs at him and says, well, you're a nothing. Right, you're 6 inches tall compared to Goliath. And David says, it's not about height, it's about courage and faith. And that's exactly the point. Shaul's choice was external. Bachur v'tov, mishichmo v'mala, gavoh mikol ha'am. And it doesn't work. When Shaul fails, and he will, after the various stories, etc., Shaul fails, and Battle of Amalek, chief amongst them, when Shmuel is told to appoint a successor to Shaul, he's sent to the house of Yishai. And we find the following little vignette. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel. No, sorry, let me go back one pasuk. They come to the house of Yishai, And Yishai kind of presents his sons to Shmuel. Remember, Shmuel was the one who appointed Shaul. So now we're a few years later. Vayaret Eliav. He sees Eliav. Vayomer, the oldest. Vayomer, ach, neged Hashem Mishicho. Clearly, this one is God's anointed one. This is the one chosen. If amongst Yishai there's a son appropriate to be the king, it must be this. First of all, he's the oldest. And second of all, he just looked the part. What does looking the part mean? Well, we only have one model for king of Israel, tall, handsome, Bachur Vatov. To which God says to Shmuel, Yomer Hashem O Shmuel, whoops, sorry. Sorry about that. That's what happens when upset, just a little too sensitive. Vayomer Hashem El Shmuel, Al tabet el ma'eyu ve'el govoa komato. Don't look at his appearance. Don't look at his height. He may be handsome. He may be tall. But you know what? We've been down that road. Where did it get us? It got us Shaul. And Shaul failed. Ki me'astiu. I rejected this one, referring to Eliav, but also double entendre referring to Shaul. And here's the key phrase. Ki lo shireh adam, ki adam yireh le'inayim, v'ashem yireh le'levav. Man sees the outward appearance. Man sees with the eyes. God sees the heart. And so God says to Shmuel, I will tell you the right one, and it may not be the one that you and everybody else think is the choicest. But I'll pick the right one because I'll see the heart. And so Yishai calls his next son over, Avinadav, and he passes before Shmuel, and Shmuel says, Gam bazeh? No, lo bachar Hashem, God did not choose this one. Vayaver Yishai, and then he goes to the next one, lo bachar Hashem, not chosen. Remember Shaul, the word by Shaul is bachur, right? Chosen. Vayaver Yishai, shivat banav lifnei Shmuel. Seven of his sons come before Shmuel, vayomer Shmuel, Yishai, lo bachar Hashem, v'ele, everyone is rejected. So Shmuel finally turns to Yishai and he says, that's all you have? There's got to be somebody else. So Yishai says to him, oh, Sha'ar Katon, there's one more yet. The youngest. He's out with the sheep. He's out in the fields. He's sunburned. He's ruddy. He's unkept. He doesn't, right? He's a shepherd. You know what? Let's take a look. I'm not leaving until he comes. So they bring David in. And you know what? He is Admon. What does Admon mean? Comes the word Adom. Ready, ruddy. He looks weather-torn. He looks red.
Sunburned.
Sunburned complexion. He looks muddy. He looks Admonika. They're connected to Edom, which is Esav. Esav had that characteristic, right? Im yefe einayim. He had handsome eyes. If the only part of David you could say was handsome was yefe einayim, it was pleasant to look at. So odd description, right? He's Admoni, Mifeinayim, Tovroi, not bad looking. And God says to him, this is the one. Sorry, keeps doing that to me. Vayomer Hashem kum shecheu kizo. So you have this tension in David's world, right? David is both Admoni, he's got a little bit of Esav, Yefei Naim, he's got a little bit of Leah, Benei Leah Rakot, he's got a little bit of stature, V'tov Ro'i, but he's little, and he's not your typical vision of what a warrior of Israel, tall, striking, handsome, long hair, right? He's not that vision. It's not that image. the image of the kings of Israel were images of Shaul, of Shalom, all the other sons of Yishai, tall, striking, warrior types. David didn't strike you as that. He ended up being that because Hashem, because what the pasuk says, God sees the heart. But that's the mystery here. So if I come back to our psukim, the notion of David being in, and this theory of Bezak, that David is drawn to this beauty, external beauty, as a weakness. So either what Bezak is saying is that sort of the opposite attracts, right? David did not have that characteristic, so he yearned for it, pined for it. On the other hand, in the context of this particular moment in David's life, the critique that David's downfall is the weakness for beauty, but Sheva, Shalom, and Adonai, I don't see it as a compelling argument. However, what I think what Bezak has done is he's highlighted something which got me thinking that maybe the understanding of this perek is the exact opposite. Namely, the contrast between what David is suggesting and what the people are seeing. In other words, Avshalom's beauty, Avshalom lo haya ish yefeh b'chol Yisrael, was a symbol of eligibility to the throne in the eyes of whom? Not in the eyes of David, but in the eyes of the people. The same people who chose Shaul, the same people who will choose Avshalom, the same people who will eventually choose Adoniyahu. The people are always drawn to these externals of strength and beauty and dominance and power. David represents a different kind of leadership. And so what you have in this moment of this tension is David is invited Avshalom back to Yerushalayim. He's invited him back from exile. To what end? Sorry. To what end? To what purpose? What is ultimately David's goal in bringing Avshalom back? To keep his eye on him. Again, it comes back to that same question. Why invite him back and then not invite him to Yerushalayim? But he, for whatever reason, he has acquiesced to ending of Shalom's exile. In the eyes of the people, however, that message is what? In the eyes of the people, that message is
He should be the king.
That Avshalom has been forgiven, that Avshalom, that all is good, that everything's happy in the royal family, that Avshalom is all live happily ever after, and Avshalom will be the next king of Israel. He certainly looked the part. He certainly felt the part. If I combine the Bezak's theory and the Medak's theory, and he looked the part and he felt the part. He had the beauty and he had the arrogance. He looked the part and he felt the part. And so Avshalom fully anticipates that he's going to come back to Yerushalayim with one goal, which is to be designated crown prince, to be assigned the position of the heir to the throne. After all, that position has been vacated. Who held the position of the crown prince? Who was the heir to the throne?
Amnon.
Amnon's position is the crown. That position of the crown prince has been vacated by Amnon. Not voluntarily, but it has been. Right? So Avshalom is the next candidate. He's the next in line by age. A couple of years later, Adoniah will make the same case. I'm the next in line. Avshalom. Amnon is gone. Avshalom is gone. The next in line is Adoniah. He'll make the same argument, and he's as beautiful as Avshalom is, and therefore he's got all the external trappings. Right? So it's a qualification for being the king. Qualification for being the crown prince is you need to be the son of the king, you need to be the next in line, and you need to be tall, handsome, striking warrior.
It's like our prime minister without the warrior.
Right. and get political, but okay.
When they picked David, he wasn't the oldest.
Correct. And it's everything that David's not. It's everything that David's not. David wasn't the oldest. David wasn't the handsomest. David wasn't the strongest. David was a different kind of king. And at this moment in David's life, the whole context here is that the struggle is a struggle for the position of David, because David is seen as passed by. So who's standing in line? Who's next in line? Who's ready for that position? Who's going to, let's go back to Shaul. Let's go back to the tall, handsome, dark hair, long hair. Let's go back to the warrior, to the beauty, to the externals. And so Avshalom is ready. And David brings him back to Yerushalayim. And then David says to him, comes back to Yerushalayim, and David's proclamation is, you are not welcome in the palace. You shall not set eyes on me. You are go to your house and go to house arrest. Why? Because David understood very well. The moment Avshalom steps foot in the palace, Avshalom becomes the crown prince claim heir to the throne. And we're 6 inches from the rebellion. And in David's mind, this one will not sit on my throne. Avshalom can come back to Yerushalayim. Avshalom can come back to the family get together on Thanksgiving. Avshalom can sit at the table. Avshalom is not going to sit on my throne. And if I read the parak that way, then let's come back to the story.
I couldn't find parak that way.
Why is my phone talking to me? If I read the story that way, king invites him back and says, he goes home, he doesn't step foot in the palace. And everybody's surprised. Avshalom lo haya ish yafeh b'chol Yisrael. Avshalom was beautiful, and Avshalom had long hair, and Avshalom had a family, and Avshalom was ready. And David said no. For 2 years, David said no. For all intents and purposes, from a perspective of a claim to the throne, David could have left him in Yerushalayim. It could have left him in Eretz Geshur. For all the good it will do him. My throne, he will not have a claim to. That begs the question, of course, again, same question we started with, which is, why bring him home if you're not going to give him the throne? Assuming that Shlomo is not in the equation yet.
Did he want to embarrass him?
Okay. Maybe I'm not answering that question tonight, just because we have to go back to the Shat Kui to really understand why he brings him home. But for now, that's the question. Why bring him home if you're not going to put him on the throne? But David clearly has that in mind. He'll come back to Yerushalayim. He can come back to Yerushalayim. But Yisob Avshalom Beito, but to his house and not to the palace. So after 2 years, Avshalom is getting a little annoyed. After all, Avshalom knows nothing of this. Avshalom didn't have a chance to listen to this year. Right? Avshalom doesn't understand that David's not going to let him on the throne. So Veishlach Avshalom Yoav. Lishloach oto alamelach. So Avshalom sent for Yoav to send him to the king, to send Yoav as a messenger to the king to tell him, hey, wait a second, there's a chair miss over there that's a vacant. That's mine. Yoav refused to come to him. Yoav refused to go to Avshalom. I won't do that again. Yoav refused to go to Avshalom. I'm confused. Wasn't Yoav the one who sent for Avshalom? Wasn't Yoav the one who hired the Shat Kuit to convince David to bring Avshalom home? Avshalom wants to have a conversation with him. Lo avala voila. Doesn't want to go to him. Beishlach. Oh, sorry about that. Can't have to remember not to click. Beishlach od shenit. So Avshalom sends for Yoav a second time. Lo avala vo. Doesn't want to go. So by the time Avshalom is sitting there in under house arrest, and Avshalom and Yoav is refused his call or summons twice. If you were the crown prince, we would call and you summoned the general to a conversation, might be considered somewhat dangerous or treasonous. So Avshalom is a not to be trifled with. Avshalom decides to take matters into his own hands. Vayomer el Avadav. He says to his servants, Yoav al Yadi. Out my window, I can see that Yoav has a very large field. And that field is right next to my field. Velosham Sorim, he's got barley there. He's got his whole economy there. So I'm going to tell you what to do, my servants, my loyal servants. You know, the servants were the ones who he commanded to kill Amnon, and they were so willing to comply. And he says to them, Lechu v'hatzitu abesh. Go set Yoav's field on fire. That should catch his attention. You think? Vayatzitu avdei Avshalom et hachalka b'esh. So Avshalom's servants went, and they set Yoav's field on fire. Well, that got Yoav's attention. Vayakam Yoav, vayavoy el Avshalom. Yoav went to Avshalom. Habayta, to his house. He said to him, Lama hitzitu avadecha tachaka sheli ba'esh. What did you do? You sent your servants to set my field on fire? So Avshalom says to Yoav, wait a second. Yomer Avshalom, Yoav, I'm not the injured party here. So you're not the injured party here, I am. Yomer Avshalom, Yoav, hinei shalachti elecha lemor bo'ena. I already sent the message to you. I said to you, come forth, bohena. Ve'eshlacha lotcha lemelach. I have a message for you to deliver to the king. Lama labata lemor. And what's that message? Lama bati migishur. Why did you bring me from Geshur? Tov li odanisham. I was better off there. There I didn't sit in house arrest. There I sat next to my grandfather. There I sat next to my Zayda. You know who my Zayda was? The king of Geshur. There I had a position in the palace. Here I'm in a house arrest in my own home. I want to see the king. If there is iniquity in me, if I'm not worthy, let him kill me. Let him stand there, judge me guilty and kill me. But otherwise, I want to see the king. You understand, seeing the king here is not a family reunion. See the king means there's a chair next to the king's throne. I want it. That's my chair. I don't want to sit in it. So Yoav says, fine. Yoav al-Melech. Yoav comes to the king. He tells him. Something happens. Something clicks. Something changes. And David says, fine. Vayikral Avshalom, calls Avshalom in. Vayavol HaMelech sits with the king, comes to the king. Vayishtachulo. Avshalom bows to him upon Alapav Arza to the ground. Lifnei HaMelech. Vayishak HaMelech LaAvshalom. And the king kisses Avshalom. And in that kiss, the reunification of David and Avshalom, the reunification of father and son who have been separated by so much turmoil. Sounds like another famous kiss. A father-son separated by years of turmoil and separation. Right? When Yosef and Yaakov...
Not really.
When Yosef and Yaakov finally meet, V'yeso Yosef merkavto me'abayal likrat Yisrael aviv Goshna. Yosef gets off his chariot and he comes to Yaakov, his father in Goshen. V'yirai lav, he sees him. Vayipol al tzavarav, vayef kal tzavarav, od. He fell on his neck and cried, he fell on his neck and cried some more. Vayipol al tzavarav, vayef kal tzavarav, od. Is that not exactly what we have? Vayishak ha-melech lav shalom, he kissed him. Kissed him, except that he kissed him without. What's the difference? There it says, Vayipol tzavarav vayefk. And here it says, Vayishak ha-melech lav shalom. Yaakov and Yosef cried. David kissed Avshalom. What is the significance of a kiss?
It wasn't emotional.
There's very little emotion here.
Yeah.
Very little emotion. What else is signified by this kiss? It almost has a certain...
Then he's not going to be the king.
The kiss, I think, is the opposite.
Oh, you do?
The exile is, he has no position in my palace. I won't see him. Now he sees him. Everything that he said before, I will not see the king. He will not see my face. Now he sees my face. He will not step foot in my palace. Now he comes into his palace. I will not forgive him for the murder of Amnon. What is Vayishak HaMelech Lav Shalom, if not a royal pardon? He's a murderer. He's killed his brother. You cannot embrace him and kiss him unless you have pardoned him. Unless you have forgiven him. And that's what David does. And we finally have that moment of reconciliation. David pardons Avshalom. David forgives Avshalom. David kisses him and says, fine, you are accepted here in the royal family, in the royal palace. You are allowed in back home. Fine. You know what happens next? I'm going to read one pasuk from Perek Tetvav. Vayhi miachrechen vayas lo Avshalom merkava v'susim v'chamishim ish ratzim lefanav. Horses, chariots, 50 men running before him. Exactly the language Adoniyahu used to begin his rebellion is the beginning of Avshalom's rebellion. Avshalom has no chariot and horses as long as he's under house arrest. He has no vehicle of transportation, of governmental transportation. He has no horse and chariot. He has no Haman and Mordechai on the horse. Mordechai on the horse, Haman before him, the other way around in Haman's mind. He's not sitting on the horse with the man riding before him saying, Kachay aseh l'ish asher melech hafetz bikaro. As long as he's under house arrest, everybody understands where David stands vis-a-vis Avshalom. The moment he kisses him, right, the moment Vayishak David l'Avshalom, all of that's gone. He's given him a royal pardon. He's invited him back into the party. He's invited him back at his right hand. Does he expect him to be the heir to the throne? No. But what happens is sometimes what David wants doesn't always happen. And Avshalom has his own agenda. And the moment David enables Avshalom back with a public pardon, he's enabled the rebellion to begin. So now the question is actually a double question. Why do you invite him back if he wasn't planning to pardon him? And why does he eventually acquiesce to pardoning him? Why does he, in the one hand, stand strong and tall, not in my backyard? This is not happening. Avshalom is in exile because he killed his brother. And this, okay, he can come home, but he can't have a seat at the palace. He can't see my face. He can't be in the throne. And then, you know what, 2 years later, okay, you know what, I want him here. He's not going to be king, but I want him there.
Is he listening to y'all?
He's going to sit on the chair of the crown prince, but we're not going to give him that title. And Avshalom's not going to take it? Where is Yoav in all of this?
Yoav advised him, didn't he?
Yoav advised him to bring Avshalom back. Yoav advised him to enable this moment of reconciliation and pardon. On the other hand, Yoav is a mystery, right? Because on the other hand, Yoav is one who refuses to see Avshalom. When, as long as the king says no, that Yoav is aloof and hands off and distance, and Yoav so much so that Avshalom eventually gets angry at Yoav and burns his field, which is a stupid thing to do because you don't really want to tick off Yoav. It's like the wrong person to get angry. Remember, Yoav is the person who killed Avner ben Ner in cold blood. Yoav is the one who killed Amasa ben Yet in cold blood. Yoav is the one who of all the people in David's entourage, the one person you don't want to get angry is Yoav. That's just a matter of self-preservation.
Is Yoav a member of King David's family?
Yes, Yoav is David's nephew.
Oh.
Tsruya is an interesting observation. Tsruya, Yoav ben Tsruya, Sa'el ben Tsruya, Avishai ben Tsruya. The three sons of Tsruya are all identified throughout Tanakh as ben Tsruya, every time they're mentioned. Why? Because Tsruya is David's sister. They're the only three people in Tanakh who are identified by the name of their mother. Consistently. We never even know who their father is.
Why is that?
And the reason for that is because it tells us the connection to David. Right? Yoav ben Ploni doesn't tell me anything. Yoav ben Tsruya tells me he's David's nephew. So his whole connection to David, why David is helpless always, right? David is the one who constantly bemoans the fact that these B'nai Tsruya are a troublemaking group, right? They're tough bandits. They're hard. And David is not like that. And yet, what am I going to do with you, B'nai Tsruya? David has been crutching about this from the very beginning. He'll fire Yoav for the position of chief general because he kills Masa ben Yetter. It comes a little bit later. So David has him fired. And a chapter later, he's back on the job. One thing you don't want to do is you don't want to mess with Yoav. Avshalom didn't learn that lesson. Avshalom messed with Yoav, he'll pay a heavy price for it. But we'll come to that, Bezrat Hashem. But in the meantime, the mystery of David's role here and the relationship with Avshalom only deepens. He brings him back, and yet he doesn't bring him back. He eventually, 2 years later, he eventually cowls and gives in to the desire to see Avshalom, to kiss Avshalom, to pardon Avshalom. And then literally one sentence later, Avshalom launches his full-scale rebellion. Yoav's role in all of this is a mystery. Why? What this Ishat Kuit, what did she accomplish in all of this? The mystery deepens. So Bezrat Hashem, we continue next week. And hopefully we'll get some answers.
May Yasher Koach. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rabbi. That was terrific.
My pleasure. My pleasure.